basically the principle of simultaneous invention. Of course, the telephone was invented by multiple people at the same time. Of course, telegraph was the same way. Because every technology, in order to have a telephone, you have to have fine wire of a consistent, of a consistent diameter. You have to know about metallurgy. You have to know about copper. You have to know something about electromagnetic theory. You have to be able to make batteries. You have to be able to wrap cotton around wire. You have to know about shellac. You have to know about making metal, precision machinery. And until you have all those things, you can't make a telephone. You couldn't make a telephone in 1600 because no one had those things. They could make it in 1800. So when it comes to making a bulletin board, or to, just to pick some arbitrary thing, you have to have computers that humans can walk up to that have a keyboard and a display and have that loop be shorter than paper tape, I mean, than punch cards, which weren't conversant anyways. And you have to have copper wire between buildings that with modems, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not surprising that someone had a computer and a phone line and a modem, and somebody else has one. You'll figure out some way to make bits work.
Tom Jennings has been many things: inventor, technologist, maker, automobile aficionado, squirrel wrangler, and much more. This time on the Plutopia podcast, we feature Tom's recent visit to the Plutopia Facebook Live show.
So Tom is an artist, among other things, and a technician. And he's based in, you're still in Los Angeles, right?
Not going anywhere.
Right on. So, and Tom is known, well, when I met Tom, we were talking about his work on FidoNet, which was like a message and file networking system for BBSs. And it really was the internet before there was an internet, right?
No, it's stored in, it's hard to, there's no real model today. The only analogies I can make are all obsolete themselves. So, but it was a store and forward email system, but it, if you gave it a day, it acted like internet mail.
Well, the internet sort of acts that way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to remember,
that
you remember that book that, John Quarterman wrote called The Matrix.
Yeah, I have one over there somewhere.
So I think that you were featured in The Matrix.
It's so long ago, I don't remember.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's such ancient history now. Back then, it all felt so cutting edge.
It was.
And I guess it was, you know.
And it, like ever, all things passed. So.
If you were in The Matrix, were you one of the evil programs?
No, the red pill, blue pill thing. No, I'll take pills, but neither of those two.
So there's really no way you could, like, if you wanted to create another FidoNet, that depended on there being all these BBSs, right? So you could
the FidoNet was based upon, and we basically used the telephone network, the POTS network, and that doesn't exist. So
can I ask a question just real quick for the layperson? What is a BBS?
Oh, young one.
Oh, hey, that's
it's
a good
a forum.
One.
It's a forum. That's okay. What they were. They were forums. They're bigger, you know.
What does it stand for?
Bulletin board.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. I should have brought it. I have a photograph of a bulletin board. The model was, quite consciously, it's a metaphor for the bulletin board that was inside the door in the little lobby thing of a supermarket, where it's like lawnmower for sale. That was literally, you put up the post-it, lawnmower for sale, $5, come get it.
So like Craigslist.
Yeah, probably, but it was anybody could publish, anybody could take the card down. They're always obsolete. Wow. I always sold that 3 weeks ago. I forgot to take the card down. And that was the model. And the early ones were basically, you'd log in at some ridiculously slow speed with a handheld modem and you'd type in text, but the speed doesn't really matter. It doesn't change the way it works. And you'd leave a message and then you go away. And then a week later, usually with sort of the time scale, you'd call back in and you'd see if there's any posts. Checking in once a day seemed excessive.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so the time scales were just, you know,
early on, I tried that.
I'll be asking those kind of questions.
Those are good questions to ask. But no, you're grasping it because those are the things that are different. The things that are the same is to Joe Schmo or all. You could say to all from that was filled in. Blah 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 blah. Save it. Go away. wait a week, come back and find replies if you were lucky.
So the thing is that there were all sorts of bulletin board systems, and eventually they were sort of linked to each other. FidoNet was one way that they were linked to each other, and then other there was a way of linking them through the internet. What was that system for exchanging mail through the internet that they had?
Well, there was UUNet.
UUNet, yeah.
Which is based on UU copy, which is Unix to Unix copy. It was basically we have two boxes and there's a port, and a port is just a device. Like literally the jack on the back of your box would have an address, a name inside the box, and you'd say, copy a file to the serial port with bit rate, all that awful stuff. And then the other computer would have a cable connected to it, and then it would be receiving, and when the data came, it would just copy the data over. That was the basis for the whole thing, just moving files between machines.
Yeah, the first way I remember exchanging email with people who were just not somewhat local was through UUNet, through a BBS, and you could send email to other BBSs that were also linked to UUNet. But I think the way they linked was they would do dial-up to the internet to upload and download email. So Swift.
All these systems were built on tools that were laying around, on text editors creating files. So I worked in a system in the middle 70s, the Data General machine, where they had I realized more of this later because I was like 18 to 20 at the time. So who they were MIT MIT software geeks in 75. And we was like six of us programmers and on this mini computer system. And we would have a mailbox that was our initials, our name. And if I wanted to leave Tom Campbell a message, I would go to Tom's mail file and I would add text to the end of his file. And then he would go in and edit it. And when he did it, he would delete it. And if I had to reply, he'd go into my file. So the idea of email is just, it's not particularly complicated. It's just leaving people notes as long as it's been writing. So, so disk files have been around a long time. And then ways to copy files between machines, besides putting it on a tape and then transporting the tape and mounting the tape, which is perfectly legitimate way to move files, thumb drive, which is the same way, they just got more and more complicated. So UU copy, I mean, I don't know it that well, and it's been a long time, and I was never a Unix geek back then, but basically mail spools files was built up of people adding messages to it, but it just sits on the disk somewhere. And then the UU copy program on a cron job would copy that file to another computer, which would then take it apart and divvy out the messages to the individual. So then that tool was used to encapsulate files with UU and code and all kinds of bags that were added to the side. So none of it was particularly, nothing gets invented all at once.
And a lot of the connecting was through modems. Right.
Yeah, and this is basically the principle of simultaneous invention. Of course, the telephone was invented by multiple people at the same time. Of course, telegraph was the same way. Because every technology, in order to have a telephone, you have to have fine wire of a consistent diameter. You have to know about metallurgy. You have to know about copper. You have to know something about electromagnetic theory. You have to be able to make batteries. You have to be able to wrap cotton around wire. You have to know about shellac. You have to know about making metal, precision machinery. And until you have all those things, you can't make a telephone. You couldn't make a telephone in 1600 because no one had those things. They could make it in 1800. So when it comes to making a bulletin board, or to pick some arbitrary thing, you have to have computers that humans can walk up to that have a keyboard and a display and have that loop be shorter than paper tape, punch cards, which weren't conversant anyways. And you have to have copper wire between buildings that have with modems, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not surprising that someone had a computer and a phone line and a modem and somebody else has one. You'll figure out some way to make bits flow. And that's pretty much what we did. But what it was a set of protocols. That was the difference that what FidoNet did. Was partly protocols, really shitty protocols at first that I just made up ad hoc. I had literally no idea what I was doing, but when does that ever stop me? Or anyone. And the other part was modem control. And that was really the secret hidden part. That was just a lot of work. How to actually automate what humans do. Dial, misdials, reconnects, timeouts, all that kind of stuff.
I remember you telling me, oh, go ahead.
One of the early things that I loved on the internet that kind of resembles the current internet was the news groups. And you could find some strange stuff out there. And you could get involved in a flame war on one of the news groups was almost life-threatening. And it's kind of the same way now on the internet.
Yeah, but it's not symbolic so much anymore.
Is Metafilter one of the earlier or later ideas along? Are y'all familiar with Metafilter? Or is
yeah, oh yeah, I'm, I actually know the guy who founded Metafilter. It started in the early 2000s, or was it there in the 90s?
It was at least early 2000s. I mean, because I remember when I stumbled on it, I was like, oh my god, this is so awesome. But
yeah, that's Matt Howey that started that thing.
Yeah, the name is really familiar, but I don't remember. I mean, I was out of the bulletin board game by 96. I just had gotten tired of it. I wouldn't have
said it was later.
We were doing internet stuff, so before that, really, it malingered for me up until the middle 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I had been on bulletin boards because I really wanted to get on the Well, and the Well was a bulletin board. And when I first got a computer, dialing into the Well would require me to use really expensive long distance service.
Yeah.
So I had to grapple with that for years and try to find ways to economically connect with the Well and, be a fairly active member there, while not running up exorbitant phone bills that would get me in trouble with certain other people in the household. And that went on for a while. In fact, I bought a computer and a modem for that purpose. And it took me from the date that I got a computer modem, it was like 2 or 3 years before I got under the Well. And there were various ways to connect. CompuServe packet networks, or Sprint had something called PC Pursuit. You remember all those things, Tom?
Yeah, I do remember PC Pursuit. Yeah, I mean, FidoNet was based upon being super cheap. The idea of connecting in real time to a remote computer was just unthinkably expensive. I finally figured out that there was a whole bunch of things. I've regurgitated this story a number of times. I'll just skip it, about the idea of making a series of local calls across the United States and realize it's going to collapse into chaos. I finally just sit down and did the math. And even at 1200 baud, I think it was, an average best case in 1983 of 1200 bits a second, that a call after 6 PM or whatever the time slot was between San Francisco and Boston or something like that was 25 cents a minute. And at 1200 baud, you could get 2K bytes. You could get 2000 characters in 1 minute for 25 cents. And that's a whole page of text. So at that point, we did the store and forward thing. So people would type in messages all day long or not. They would be bundled up till 1 AM. Connection would be made. The phone would dial. Connection would be made. The files were sent. The files were picked up. Connection dropped. So you would basically bring the Well to yourself. I mean, in a virtual sort of
way. Wow.
That was the idea. That's what store and forward was. So it's in some ways, it's sort of like email. And then a guy named Jeff Rush in Texas, actually, I think in Austin, I think he's part of the Austin Mafia.
Yeah, I think
Or Houston. I'm not sure where the Dallas. He was a Dallas Mafia.
I remember that guy.
Yeah. I met him. He's a cool guy. We didn't have any involvement in the Echo Conference stuff. There was some politics between the Dallas crowd and the rest.
There always is with Dallas.
Yeah. So, and I ended up reconciling with people and they were all fine. But, for some reason, they saw things as competitive in a way that I don't do. I just don't do competition. I find competition really tedious. But anyways, he basically figured out a way. I had this thing where you send messages, like we said, and sort of Usenet style. Instead of you encode and making a file into a message, we had this thing called file attach. Like it would send all the messages back and forth, and it would say, "Do I have a list of files?" Then it would send all the files over. And he figured out a way to him and them. I don't know the details. It's been 40 years. Figured out a way to take bulletin boards that weren't the main one and copy them all into a file and put special markers in it so that you could send that file to another thing running the EchoMail software. And so every time you sent a message into an Echo conference that was named, it would send it a copy. It would give a copy of that message to every single bulletin board in the network. And every other bulletin board would do the same thing with the same messages. So it was called, that's why it's an Echo. You yell into it and there's copies of it everywhere. So it was a self-healing, self-distributing network with one danger: infinite mirror, infinite echoes. So he had a system where his message XYZ, oh, I already got that one, throw it on the floor. That's what prevented, anyways, he figured all that stuff out and retries, and it was technically astute. And that's what most people think of. See, that's what most people think of FidoNet as, is Echo Conference, where the same way people think of the internet, they think the internet is the World Wide Web, or the World Wide Web is the internet. It's simply not at all. It's just one port out of 32,000.
Well, you're a big fan of...
You're muted, John.
You're a big fan of old technology. I remember going through your old website, and you have a lot of documentation for dead tech and for just cool stuff that, you know, no one has probably looked at in many years, but I enjoyed going through it. What got you involved in all this old collectibles?
The history, I mean, well, I don't know. There's something alien about them. I'm not doing it so much now for all kinds of reasons, but they're at once familiar and alien. And this stuff is all the stuff I'm really interested in is well before my time. I'm really, if it's got a plastic case, I'm generally not interested. The first couple of generations of computers, when they were making logical machines out of television tubes, radio tubes, it was where the thought got instantiated in metal. And electronics. That was what was really interesting to me. The early, super early stuff, Alan Turing and before, and plus or minus. Once again, into the second and third generation computers, they're just kind of big, ugly machines. I mean, likes to look at, but I wouldn't want to own one. It is aesthetically sort of nice, but I don't have that much of it, and I certainly don't use any anymore. I'll make fake old stuff. I don't have anything laying around. Yeah, there's a bunch over there.
And vintage automobiles, particularly the Rambler American, how did that come about?
They weren't vintage when I started.
With that.
they weren't old when I started. They were a little old. I don't know. I mean, it's, you just sort of follow thing. You follow the path with heart. You know, you just sort of follow a thing that has some juice in it, and it ends up getting fairly specialized on really this really narrow range of 1958 to 1963 Rambler Americans. It's only that model. And that model is based on the 1950 to 1956 Nash Rambler, single model of a single manufacturer that was obsolete by 58. And in some ways, it's just a horrible car. Its technology was obsolete in 1960. It was obsolete in 1958 when they introduced it. I mean, literally, it's obsolete. It's terrible. But there's something really interesting about the car, and it's extraordinarily well made. And so I'm basically re-engineering suspension parts now. So I have an audience of like maybe 50 worldwide, and you end up finding yourself doing completely ridiculous things.
Yeah, the first automobile I purchased with my own money was a 69 American Motors Rambler, and it was a bit low tech. It didn't last long. I wasn't real good about treating it the way you're supposed to treat fine pieces of machinery. I treated it more like a rusty crescent wrench.
My current daily driver is a 1968 Rambler American that was one owner for 47 years. It's 200,000 miles, and it's I wouldn't say it's immaculate. It looks like a 5-year-old car, and I actually just visited the original owner in Kingman, Arizona. He got to sit in it. He's 97 years old.
Year was it?
68.
Wow, that's
the
very
cheapest
cool.
car in America, $1,865. I have all the, oh my God, it's crazy. So the binder for it is called St. Desmond. He saved the original ad. That was cut out of the early time. And all the receipts. Not all the receipts, but it's kind of shocking. So it's a really specialized, really weird thing. It runs great. It's 23 miles a gallon. I drive it all over the Southwest. Getting it, drive to New York right now. No limitations.
I noticed you were writing about having to build parts for it because they just don't exist anymore.
Yeah, the 68 is actually, you can still buy parts online, Rock Auto. It's a shocking number of stuff. It was a really nice, that was kind of the peak of their technology. And then it was all downhill from there. In the 70s, the malaise era killed everybody, all the American manufacturers. And the 50s stuff, which is my current specialty, my little race car, that I'm manufacturing and re-engineering suspension parts for. That's completely ridiculous. But that's just, you know, I'm going to do a 100-mile-an-hour average sort of time trial with it.
You're going to go 100 miles an hour average?
100-mile-an-hour average over 260-mile runs. So, yeah, it's going to be, it's pushing the technology kind of past its past its prime. And it's a little bit unsafe. But I'll do, you know, of course, I'm not going to be stupid. I roll bar and cage. And that's why I'm building a new suspension for it.
Well, that's an interesting way to keep busy. I notice you also have not been real pleased with political developments of late.
No, I'm afraid that people aren't quite seeing that I think we're going to have large-scale violence. I don't see how we're going to avoid it.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't. Who knows what form it will take?
Yeah, it's like we're suddenly in Russia in the 1950s. In a way, some of the people that are cropping up.
Those photos or video of the National Guard just all over the, I mean, laying down, they're just going to, I mean, my God, it's just, they're all in the Capitol. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's pretty intense. It's pretty intense. It's shocking. I can't believe where we are. And I'm so, I think the overall thing I've heard from people is embarrassment.
Well, you know how we've all, and as I will say, we all, because anybody that I'm going to talk to is at this point an us and them thing. And I'm just side of, I don't see there's two sides. I think there's one side, and then there's a bunch of fascists and violent racist bigots. And the rest of us are just muddling along trying to figure out how to not be a total jerk and how to get along with everybody. And the people that we put up, we have, and I'd say that, you know, this us old white guys, and you are much younger, and Susie, and we've been putting up with unpleasant people as peers our entire lives. The bigots, the racists, the football jocks beating up the fags like me, people harassing us everywhere we go. And they basically got themselves. We're always, you know, they managed to get cultural space. We have to worry, you know, where they get upset by saying happy holidays instead of Christmas. Like, oh my God, talk about delicate flowers. Yet we've accommodated them our entire life. Never mind what they do to black people that we, not that we put up with, but we didn't see.
For lots of reasons,
not all good.
My generation's the same. I'm 50, and I was brought up in small town Texas where we were Christian and we had guns, and you know, the minority population stayed over on what we called the ridge on the other side of the tracks. I mean, I don't know what millennials do now, but it's very similar to what you're talking about. I went through that too. And I'm gay also. And it was a small town, and it was very difficult. It was scary. You couldn't come out.
We're not guilty, but we're responsible. Right.
Absolutely.
And so these people and we can say these people because they are kind of self-defined as that, have been around our whole lives, and we haven't known what to do with it. And the stories we've been lied to the whole time, all of us, white and black, we are all lied to about how the world is arranged and assembled. And the pimple popped. Trump made it pop. But,
man.
You know, if you read
he made being a bully kind of an okay thing. You know, it's like in all the years that we've had one president after another, I don't think we've ever had one that was just an out and out bully. You know, Reagan maybe a little bit, but
I think Nixon probably was
nothing quite like this. And the problem with Trump is that he's really not very smart, and he's mostly just aggressive. And he's got, what do they call it, Dunning-Kruger? You know, I mean, he's got this thing where he believes that he really is smart, even though he's really not very smart. And that's kind of like, I mean, I grew up in a little town in Texas too, and I was bullied a lot. Mm-hmm. And those are the same kinds of guys. Those are the guys who would come up to you on the playground and kick you in the butt, you know?
Yeah, everybody was picked on separately. We never ganged up and, you know, for all kinds of reasons.
I think Nunes and Cruz and these guys were bullied. And I think that's one reason that they're falling so easily back into it, because it's happened before.
It's power. And I've long since stopped trying to figure out why I am not outraged anymore. I'm done with outrage. The moral outrage is a way to distance yourself from it and be not responsible for it. It doesn't really matter what we think of it. It's happening. It's an act. And the physical act matters, and we can't deny that part. And that's the only part that matters. But words are cheap. We can all say anything we want.
Yeah, it's a question of what you do.
What you do that matters. And they're doing terrible harm.
Okay. Well, I see that Donald Trump has finally been reduced to the equivalent of the villains on the Scooby-Doo cartoons, who was always unmasked, and they would have to say something like, "I'd have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you meddling kids." And let's hope he stays that way.
We'll see what happens on the 20th. You know, I mean, not that the 20th decides for our city, kind of major, but it will be a major indication of where we're at and what's going to happen next.
Oh, you know, before this is going to be like their big thing is planned for Sunday, you know, the 17th. Yeah. And the thing is that I don't think that these guys really care anymore whether Trump is president or not. It's not about that anymore. They wanted an insurrection. They want to take over. They want to seize the government because they don't. There's so many things they don't like about the way things have been done.
The things that they don't want are what the things they wanted and didn't want when we were in high school, and it hasn't really changed.
It's kind of interesting. I was reading something today about, you know, we kind of think about, well, in World War II, we fought the fascists and we won, and, you know, we were all against Hitler, we were all against the Nazis. That's actually not true. There were a lot of Nazi sympathizers in the U.S. Most of what they tried to do was they tried to keep us out of the war so we wouldn't, like, squelch the guy. But, you know, they were here. They've been here all along. And they have always wanted to get their foot in the door. And Trump was their foot in the door.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had they had Nazi rallies in Madison Square Garden. You know, the German American Bund and all of those, all their ilk were just big deal back in the 30s, and they were anti-war, but for a totally different reason. They just didn't want to get in the way of their buddy Hitler.
And the way I see it now is we have there's sort of two paradigms. Openness, calmer, sharing, enjoying difference, or at least being surprised with it and dealing with it as face-to-face, like non-hierarchical humans. Then there's the old aristocracy-based hierarchy. Somebody's got to be at the bottom, sorted by race, money, and power. And there's two worldviews, and it's a war against worldviews. And we want to, speak loosely and broadly, we want an open society where we can mix and match as we see fit. We don't want unfairness. We want everyone to be treated equally, whatever that means. We want everyone to have good health and access to food and education and all those kind of things. And a lot of people do not want those things to happen.
Do you legitimately, though, think that any society can function without some sort of class system? In a capitalistic, if you have capitalism, is that,
I just don't know. Maybe those things will fall out, but certainly maybe people will self-segregate into the hierarchy. It doesn't need to be enforced in law. And it doesn't need to be.
I agree.
I have no idea. I just don't know. I mean, are there cultures that are, the thing is, this pops up in the news. Well, look at what New Zealand is doing. New Zealand's a great place, but it's also a tiny monoculture. And so is Japan. I mean, Japan is, I was surprised. I love Japan. I love Tokyo. I like the Japanese people. It's ethnically 97.5% ethnic Japan. The next ethnic group is Korean, and it's like 0.5%. And then it's not a complaint. It's a monoculture. And so Japanese people, here, I'm generalizing someone else's culture. I mean, feel a little more cohesiveness with Japanese-ness in a way that Americans don't, because we're just much more diffuse, and it's not a bad thing. Neither is better or no worse. They're just different. And I like the American system where you walk in and you go, wow, you're completely different from me. What the hell are you doing? This is great. Like we live in Los Angeles, and there's mini malls when we first moved here. You walk into them, it's like we're looking at these stores. We don't even know what kind of food is for sale here. It's great. Let's go try it. And that threatens some people. And then other people, we like novelty. And maybe that's the basis of this sort of cultural war we're having. It's like those of us who seek novelty and like change and willingness to adapt, and some of us who are afraid and want to shun it and control it.
That sounds more like curiosity.
You know, there are a lot of regions or cities like Austin or San Francisco that try to pride themselves upon their diversity.
Yeah.
I lived, you know, in Berkeley and Oakland for 40 years, and it was, sure, there was that, but there was also a lot of segregation, a lot of, you know, racial inequality that people would... They knew it was there, but it's like, well, let's not talk about it because it's going to, you know, harsh our buzz about how diverse we are. And Austin is a bit of the same way. You know, we're diverse. I mean, but the city was built upon a city plan that said everything to the east of Interstate 35 is blacks and Mexicans. Yeah, that's the way they looked at it. And there are a lot of those, I'm sure, L.A.
I think every American city has some of that. But, you know, then there's lots of places. Houston is a port city and has lots of diversity in it. Long Beach does. New York City, you know, is famous for it. So does Los Angeles. Every city has all of these things. And it also has all the bigots in these places, too. I don't think it's so much geography-based. It's mindset-based and culture-based. There's just something really wrong with this particular flavor of fundamentalist, Christian-driven, white supremacist, hierarchy-based culture that wants to suppress people who aren't them. That's really the core of what everything I've heard coming out of all this, you know.
And they're so scared. I mean, that's where the hate is from, is that for, I guess... you lose power if you have to share.
Yeah. Well, the assumption is zero sum game. Like, well, if I give you something, then I'm going to lose something, which is, it's nonsense. Well, maybe under a capitalist system that has been arranged to be the case, but I don't even think that's necessarily the case. Certainly it hasn't been tried. So,
right. Right.
Well, you can't be a happy oligarch without having the unhappy downtrodden underneath you.
I don't know. I just don't know. But anger, I mean, who can't get, I'm angry now, but you know, I'm not always angry. I'm not angry at you. I'm not angry at everybody. I'm angry for things that I can usually articulate the thing that I'm angry about. But this insurrection seems to be just anger at the world. And it always at people who are not me.
Well,
what do you do with it? I don't know what we're going
to
do with it.
Well, you have to take it really seriously. And maybe we haven't, you know. Maybe we haven't taken it seriously enough. It used to be that when we talked about like the John Birch Society people or the conspiracy theorists or all that, they're just a bunch of crazy people. And, you know, we would maybe laugh at them. Maybe that was just as bad as the bullies bullying us, you know, kicking us around. Maybe, you know, even people who have crazy ideas, you know, you need to at least listen to them. And recently there was a thing that I watched. It was kind of a longish discussion about QAnon, and they were talking about it as a cult. And they had a guy who had experience dealing with cults there and had been a member of a cult at one time. And he said the most important tool in your kit when you're deprogramming people who've been in cults is questions. You ask them questions about what they believe. And as they begin to articulate their beliefs, you kind of have a way to shine a light on those things. And the problems with their beliefs start to be more apparent. So the best way to deal with these cultural problems that we have is to figure out how to have a conversation with those people and just ask them some questions.
But haven't we been doing that largely all our lives? And they also have a stake in this, and their behavior is voluntary.
The racist, well, they sometimes
they are choosing to do this for a large scale, and it's not our responsibility to fix them, and it's not our right to meddle with them.
They don't necessarily want to answer our questions. That's for
sure. They're not interested. I don't think I could have answers.
I don't think I could have a conversation with Alex Jones, who's here in Austin, and expect him to listen to me. You know, he's just going to blow smoke.
People have to take responsibility for their own actions. It's not our responsibility to fix people. And that's not saying we shouldn't have some responsibility to take part in our local culture. And we probably all do. Here we are talking, and, you know, not that this necessarily fixes anything, but this is the way you begin doing things, as you talk to other people. Well, and I do lots of road trips, and when I go mostly go native. I don't go as the weirdo LA guy. I go to the Hot Rod Power Tour. I hung out in Southern, you know, in South Carolina. I visited a friend of mine as the out game hand. That was unusual in rural South Carolina, where the next morning, the first question that I was asked is, so I guess you don't believe in Jesus.
Oh.
And I had to converse with them, and I talked to them, and I said, no, but all the ideas that he claims to have, whatever I said, something, all the ideas that he claims to espouse, I'm all behind. Those are fine things. So don't you, do you agree with those things? Like, well, yeah, I guess so.
Well, I want to point out that, I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, in Buddhism, there's the idea of the Bodhisattva. And that's exactly what the Bodhisattva does. The Bodhisattva does take responsibility for everybody. The idea is that, you know, I can't really embrace enlightenment fully unless I work to get everybody else there, get everybody else enlightened. So from that perspective, I can see an argument for, yeah, maybe we are responsible for everybody else. Maybe we should take that responsibility. I mean, we're kind of all interdependent, whether we acknowledge it or not.
I don't think that. I mean, I understand what you're saying on a large scale, but I'm not going to take responsibility.
These days, it's got to be grounded in physical practice. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in ideas anymore like that. I didn't mean to dismiss the Buddhism part. I agree with the...
I agree with the big...
I want my actions to be grounded in practice. And the more time goes on, I want them to be grounded in practice, and I want it to be grounded in bodily practice. Because abstraction is part of the way we hide behind things. And I know I sound like I'm harsh on you. I don't mean to.
All these problems we're talking about right now, is technology and social media going to save us, or is it going to destroy us?
It just seems like it's a thing that happens in parallel and it amplifies. I mean, in some ways, the social communications and technology in general, I think, have been really amazing. I think the way the Germans didn't figure out what Hitler was up to for probably 5 years, we figured out in like a week. The aftermath of what happened on the 6th was decomposed and analyzed so much faster than historically possible at all than in the past. It's kind of extraordinary. That by the time this Sunday comes along, we will little bit examined by literally millions of people with lots of cross-pollinated discussions in rapid fire because of technology. But at the same time, the right-wing people are using it. I don't think, look, we're all coming from technology-friendly backgrounds, and we want technology to be a larger part of things, a force for good or evil or some way. But I think it's a tool like good nutrition. And if you happen to live in a place that has more food on the ground, you eat better.
Yeah, the thing that encouraged me that the geeks really are paying attention, there was a hacker that was able to scrape the entire Parler website and download like 80 terabytes of data and made it public. And it's like,
that's technical activism
at its best.
Absolutely.
You know, but does it compensate for the power existing in the first place? I mean, I don't know. They've not put a good value judgment on it. People just converse. I don't know. If you eliminated both, would the world be a better place? I don't think it would really matter. If you eliminated power, if poof, power never existed. So poof, that woman never existed. So what, how does that change anything? I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. Doesn't matter. We don't get to run the world that way. It's not a thought, you know, it's not a thought experiment. It actually exists.
I like what you said about it being a technology, being a tool. And that's how I've always looked at it. I used to get in with people who wanted to fight the PC Mac wars. And I was just like, I've got them both. And if you're a if you're a carpenter, do you only have one screwdriver and one hammer? You have tools that you need. And that's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hardware is mutated. I mean, I probably about equally one third. Well, if you go back far enough, you know, 8-bit stuff, it was MS-DOS and Phoenix DOS. And then it was all the 16-bit stuff, was all the desk views and all that junk. And then it's been Windows, Linux, Apple for me, Linux, Windows, Apple, about equally. Yeah. Right now, I'm looking at this big Apple iMac. It's great hardware. It's wonderful. It's boring, and it just works.
I miss punch cords. My first job in IT was shuffling around big metal tubs full of punch cards. And I set the world, record, according to the people at the data center, for the world's largest floor sort.
And
if you know what a floor sort is, it means I tipped these things over and there were cards everywhere. And
red
wagons full of cards.
I had to take a couple of days off so the death threats would decease.
I still have stacks and stacks, like thousands and thousands of IBM punch cards. They're really nice cardboard for making little models.
Oh, yeah. And they're great for sailing across the room and hitting the back of the head of your friends when they're something.
But, you know, hardware used to be interesting in all versions of that word. And now hardware is not interesting, really. I mean, you know, you want your computer to just work. I mean, how much time do you want to spend on your computer, right? We've done it a long time. So now I have this nice iMac, and it's really boring, and it works great. And, you know, I spent more time fiddling around this stupid camera. It's okay, because it's relatively novel technology, and I got the picture to work good, and it's just sort of working. Look, it hasn't. How many times have we had to reboot our computers during the session?
No way. Remember Net Zero? Did you guys ever remember?
I had a Net Zero account.
I worked.
Totally useless.
I actually worked from San Francisco with a company that I was working for in Chicago over Net Zero. And it dropped so often. My productivity was awful because I couldn't stay online.
Yeah. Yeah, reliability's gone way up on all this stuff. It's been that part's really nice. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I mean, the technology is, I think it's just, it's like the river we're floating in. It just, it adds all these features. I'm not sure any one of them gives us any long-term advantage. It gives everybody the, you know, goes up and then it goes down and somebody else gets it. And I don't know. Those with the most money get the most power. But when has that not been the case? Right.
It's not really supposed to work, is it?
What? What do you mean?
Any of it. Technology.
It seems to always be falling over. We just take one step and prop it back up. But it works.
I mean, like the internet, computers, and so forth. All this stuff is. It used to be that somebody would build you a chair, and the chair would just stay together, right? But if you're like streaming something over the internet and it drops, you're not really surprised that it drops. You just don't get a perfect experience with any of this technology. And it's sort of been like that all along. I mean, sort of the way the internet was built, we just sort of accepted the fact that there were flaws and faults and issues along the way. And we just lived with them, you know, and we learned to, when our computers screwed up, just reboot your computer. That'll fix it.
You make loaves of bread, and once in a while, one just comes out crappy, no matter what you do. You've just something up, you don't know what it is, you throw it out and give it to the dogs and make the next one.
If the stuff worked all the time, then all the poor tech support people would be working at McDonald's.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that I think that our tolerance for problems with things that we pay for has gone way up, because there was really no way to deliver the kind of services that we have and have them all be perfect all the time. So you just have these.
Oh, I have to say, these things come really close.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
There. Aaron, I tossed it on the cable and it woke up and I know it will still work. It is shockingly reliable. I got three computers on my hard drive that run under ridiculous conditions and never, ever, ever fail.
Homemade. It's so addictive. They don't need to chip us.
We carry them voluntarily.
We're already chipped. That IP address is going to give you away.
Once we've got AI perfected, the computers will fix themselves, or the code will fix itself.
Oh, great.
It'll be self-healing. We don't have to worry about it.
Well, I mean, they kind of do, right? I mean, it's incremental. Can you remember installing stuff? I mean, when I first Linux 386 BSD on I had the machine around until a couple of years ago, a 386 DX processor with 4 megabytes of RAM or something. It took 26 floppy disks. Well, they were the 3-inch advanced ones. 26 floppy disks to contain the source code and literally all day to compile the binary to boot the operating system. That was just the first entree, the 386 BSD, into the Unix on the PC. And that was really out there. Now, I don't know, this thing updates multiple gigabytes of gigabyte automatically in the background. I trust it. I do all the updates. It gets better. It's great, for
the most part. I bought one of the new M1 Macs and got it today. Set it up with a complete migration from the computer it was replacing. Probably didn't take more than a couple of hours, and most of that time was just files moving,
How long that used, how painful that was? Oh, God, it was so terrible. So terrible.
Yeah, I kind of missed those early days. I had a 286 from Tandy. It was a real bad buy. It would only work off of their proprietary version of MS-DOS and their proprietary programs, but it had BASIC. So I liked playing with BASIC. So I got, through that, but setting all that stuff up, my wife actually was considering putting out a missing persons report on me. I was down in the computer lab like,
that reminds me of the time that I was working somewhere and I traded a window office for the fastest computer when they bought some new computers, and they had a couple that were going to be faster than the others, and I actually somebody else was first in line for the computer, but I had a window office, so I traded the window office for that.
Right.
I didn't care whether I had a window office or not.
Now, if you're looking at a screen, a teletype.
Exactly. Job, because if you have a window, you're going to spend a lot of time looking out there and not doing what you're supposed to be doing.
I think it's interesting that along the way, there's been a kind of critical culture that's evolved, and it's kind of going back, in my case, to Fringeware. Part of what we did at Fringeware was critique the technology and the technoculture that we were in. And, it's always been sort of a culture that's self-aware and self-critical.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, no, it was. It was funny. It was an interesting moment. It was sort of like not to change the subject at all, but it's that phrase, it's Persian, paradise stands in the shadow of swords. Most people take it to mean that you need some sort of large state-like system to defend the culture that you live in. And I think, no, it's more like it's the ultimate temporary autonomous zone. You're literally, there's a standing in the shadow of a sword. There's a giant war going on and you're having a party in the interstices. And 1995 or so was like one of those interstices. It was Fringeware, Boing Boing. There was the Xenon Coded. There was a lot. Who was that guy?
Schwa.
There was like a quiet, calm in strife. It was before a lot of things. It was like a kind of a celebratory technological geekdom. Designer drugs and rave parties and
cyberpunks,
UFO with UFOs as an aesthetic, and it was one of those self-aware moments of it. And it was a very small crowd, I think, by today's standards.
It was pre-Google. And so if you wanted to find out where the cool places were on the internet, you had friends who would send you a doc that had some links in it, and you'd follow those and discover all this stuff. And then you'd share the stuff. And then that's how a lot of the, that was pre-Google, but that was a lot of fun. I discovered some weird stuff out there.
Larry Lessig's 1995 Breakpoint. 1995 was a break in the internet. 1995 and older was that stuff you're talking about. Mm-hmm. The dorky, teletype-based, you could still see the Usenet roots in some things. And
Gopher. Gopher.
Oh, Gopher, yeah, I had a Gopher.
When we built the Well Gopher, it was the first Gopher that had content that was not more or less strictly technical. And we were, we were reaching all over the place. I got the guys from Mondo 2000 to donate a bunch of text that we put on there. We had a weird mix of stuff on there. And it felt very empowering, that we could just put this stuff out there and make it available to people. And they could easily read it as long as they had internet access.
That was a huge breakpoint. And actually, I think the breakpoint in all these technologies, when... like with amateur radio, I was a ham, I'm still a ham. KF6 QFI, amateur extra. I have now operated in years.
I used to know Morse code.
I just barely did 4 or 5 words a minute to get my advanced, my amateur extra. I get there was a whole series of license little changes, and I got into the amateur extra.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm up to 20 of the past. But the first thing when a technology is new, it's a bare struggle to get anything to work at all. And all you do is end up talking about the technology on the technology. A lot of amateur radio early, especially, was like, well, why would you want the coil for your antenna? All that stuff. When the technology gets mature enough, then non-techies can use it and they want to talk. And so one of the early FiberNet things was K12Net that popped up on FiberNet first. And they had other uses for it. And then, of course, sex always follows. With amateur radio, the history of amateur radio is of racist old white guys. Holy crap, if you want to really nasty, really policing of English only and other stuff.
Yeah, you should listen to shortwave radio these days. It's nothing. Religious stations, I mean, just, 90 billion watts of power out of Quito, Ecuador.
Wow. So the amateur radio guys talked about their radios and all the difficulty of the technology. And then it wasn't exactly porn, but it's kind of like porn. The busty ladies and typewriter, ASCII art. So that's not as an ASCII, it's ITA2 art. It doesn't sound so good. So that's like that. So amateur radio never really got sort of deep penetration into the culture just because it was technically arcane. So the early internet stuff was all nerds and grad students and researchers, technicians. And then when college students got to it, then they, I wasn't one, so I don't really know what I did it, but games and gossip and code and, all kinds of stuff. And then bulletin boards, the early stuff was all nerds for nerds all the time, software programmers, bulletin board modems, hardware. And then users who weren't technical came on. And a lot of Usenet was that in the Unix world. And that was the non-techie people started taking over bulletin boards and FiberNet. And the techies didn't like it, the hardcore nerds. But, of course, that's what we were there for, right? And then sex always comes second. So bulletin boards, they get written, the sex boards get written out of history. One of the biggest boards in San Francisco was Kinky Computer, which is now relatively well-known. This guy named Bill ran it. I think it was his own software. He was a phone geek. He was a phone hacker and a Japanophile. And he ran a pretty, what you would call today, a fairly hardcore gay sex board in San Francisco. It's a kink. His phone number was Man Kink 864. Back when you used to.
What years were these? What year was that?
I moved to San Francisco in 83. I started doing bulletin board stuff right after that, 83, 84. So he had been operating for since 80 or so. Tim Pozar. Wow.
The whole thing of the kinky BBS is that's when people started flocking to them, was when they found out there was porn available.
Well,
and that's what happened to the internet. when they found out that there were news groups out there that had anything and everything, then suddenly news groups were, you know, state of the art. And then, of course, it just went on from there. But porn always seemed to be the X factor that got it going.
Yeah, it's the same as mining towns on the frontier. There's silver ore over there. We go over there in most towns. It's a bunch of weirdo criminals. And then the first thing you do is they need to dig holes. They need to build houses. They need to get some food, put in a railroad track and telegram, whatever the hell it is. And then they need to have the bar room and then the prostitutes and then the wives and then the imported slave labor and then all the usual crap place. And the internet did exactly the same thing. Bulletin boards, it's all nerds making boxes go. Then the users show up and then people want to do, you know, have porn and sex. It's just part of the way the internet certainly did that. Bulletin boards did it. FileNet did it. It sort of seems to be, it seems to be a major occupation of human beings. Sex, food, and, you know.
Is it human beings? Are we sure it's not just the guys, really, the majority of men?
Oh, probably is.
I don't know if human beings is. not all of us.
It has certainly changed because I think, especially younger and younger people are just less and less.
They're inhibited much more, I think.
Matters. Mm-hmm. Sorry?
I think they're less inhibited at this
point. Yeah, so they don't need to do those kind of big explosions of craziness. It just be like, you know. So you're right, I think it would play out differently today. I think a new technology will be, I mean, sexual matters will occupy front and center, but they'll be much more like diffuse and civilized and integrated.
Well, the reason they were so important to that generation was that generation had been, browbeaten by their parents and teachers and whoever.
Impressed.
That it was evil and you should stay away. And of course, you tell some, testosterone charged 16-year-old that he can't do it. He's like, well, I'm going to go check that out. And that's kind of how it worked.
Well, yeah, oppression, hierarchy, racism, they all take part. I mean, people act out their structures they grew up in.
I think that we grew up at a time when people were really kind of twisted about sex. And I don't know. I don't know how far back that goes. I tend to think that it came out of the Victorian era, but I don't really know. But it's like, here's this really kind of natural thing that everybody wants to do, theoretically, and you tell people that it's not okay to do it, you know, and that it's not even okay to think about it.
It was the rise of industrialization that actually started the compartmentalization and ordering and capitalist ordering, not so much pre-capitalist ordering of humans to run factories, move into cities, hierarchy and partitioning forced people into social structures that benefited bosses, and those things are not good for culture. They're good.
I mean,
for
weirdly, the weird thing about porn is that it's such an abstraction. I mean, it's like that people have to go to images and sounds and things like that to take the place of something that should just naturally be part of their lives. It's kind of a weird thing.
They actually discovered pornographic cave drawings. So it's been around. Wow.
That's a very, very, very slow moving images.
I don't want to see that. Hieroglyphic sex. I am in.
Yeah. And
no, but like Zoom. No one talks about how much sex is being done over Zoom. Come on. But it doesn't get.
I hadn't even thought about that.
Uh-huh. And you can record it and upload it right away. And you can edit it.
We have a little over a minute left. So final words, everybody.
What's the next new thing, Tom? What's in your world?
I'm planning for the spring. I'm planning on doing my my Silver State Classic Challenge, 100 miles an hour on a car, about twice its average speed. And planning on drives, planning on road trips, but I'm wondering about the safety of road trips, rural road trips in the Southwest. I mean, I'm generally worried about the safety.
As a gay man, if you have anything on any kind of bumper stickers or anything, I wouldn't do it.
I've been doing this for a long time, so I know how to defend myself.
Well, COVID safety. I mean, the problem with COVID is that there appears to be, it's becoming more infectious right now, supposedly. So if that's the case,
Yeah.
Then,
I can do some road trips that are like loops through the desert and not really see anybody except at a gas station when you're, you know.
Hold your breath and drive fast. Are you going to document this the way you did the Lemon Le Mans? I remember following that adventure, which was quite entertaining.
I do. I have documented some stuff. My website's always kind of topsy-turvy. My website is, it's still a 1995 document on purpose. It's just all text. Text and images, but there's some stuff there. I know there's so many. I don't know how to organize it, present it. I don't know who looks at it. I don't know how anybody would look at it or how to organize it. So,
yeah, we meant to talk about your website. We'll have to do that the next time.
Yep.
Welcome back. Interesting. I want one that lasts a long time. That's the catch. Listen,
you can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.